You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today, my guest is Jane Hirschfield. She's a poet and editor. She's the author, most recently, of a book of her own poems, The October Palace, and an anthology of 43 centuries of spiritual poetry by women called Women in Praise of the Sacred, published by HarperCollins. Okay, I thought I'd ask, to do the impossible in this sphere, to begin by defining terms. What is the sacred?
Interesting question. I had to ask myself that question rather late in this process because, of course, one knows it when one sees it. You don't have to define it. And it suddenly occurred to me that perhaps it would be useful for me to think about it. And for me, especially since this book encompasses so many different traditions in which the definition would be very different for each woman, my own sense and the one I am giving to them is that the sacred is that thing which is larger than ourselves, to which, when we feel connected, it gives our lives meaning. You know, it is something beyond the personal life, the narrow life of ego and personal history, that allows us to sense our connection to the world beyond us, something bigger. And, of course, in different traditions, sometimes it's a multiplicity of divinity figures. Sometimes it's a state of being, as in Buddhism, where the sacred is being awake. It's not something, it's everything. And I think, in general, that becomes, for me, the abiding definition for everyone who has mystical experience, who tastes the sacred for themselves. It becomes everything. Nothing steps outside of the sacred.
Because in a certain sense, some of my favorite sacred poetry is the tiniest, the infinity in a grain of sand poetry. And when I think of the sacred, mm-hmm. and then I think of the sunflower or the grain of sand, I always think that there's something of a dichotomy between the purity of a small poem and the enormity of the sacred.
Oh, but I think it's not a dichotomy. I think it's a great parity that, in fact, they are identical, that the sacred lives in the particular, that it is the only place you can find it is in the particular because that's what we conduct our lives in the middle of. And I think that comes out particularly in these women's poems where so often what they're talking about is an embodied spirituality, a spirituality which refuses to turn its back on this world.
Is there a distinction, or how do you distinguish between poetry and prayer?
I don't think, prayer is spoken, and poetry is a definition which gets added afterwards to thought. First there's the thought, and then afterwards, especially when you're talking about oral cultures, which many of these poems were taken mm-hmm. from women who spoke them, who were themselves illiterate and recorded by other people, after the fact someone says, oh, that was a poem. So that, for example, the Sufi saint Rabia, her prayers and her poems are identical. It's simply a matter of how one writes it down. The same with the prayers of Saint Catherine of Siena. I've read a description of how she spoke them. There were pauses, there were rhythms. It wasn't said as prose, but no distinction really. Prayer can fall into either of those genres. It's quite a different thing.
You acknowledge Stephen Mitchell and his books of spiritual poetry. How did Women in Praise of the Sacred come to be? You've done many of the translations here.
Right.
From many languages.
Right. Well, versions more than translations sometimes. Stephen, in 1989, published an anthology called The Enlightened Heart.
A great anthology.
Yes. When he was working on that, when he began work on it, he came to me and showed me his preliminary list of who he was thinking of considering, just to say, what do you think of these people, Jane? And I looked at it, and I said, it's a wonderful list, but where are the women? He had only two women on a list of 50 or more potential people for that book. And he looked a little startled and said, I don't know, Jane, where are the women? and so I started this research by helping him find more poems for his anthology. And then sometimes when I would give him something, he'd say, well, you know, this is wonderful, but I don't like the translation. Would you please make an English version of it yourself? And so my first body of work for this went into that book. And after a while, his book was done, and it ended up having 7 of the 49 poets were women. And after a while, my conscience began to nag at me, and I thought, well, you know, if I found a number of women who I'd never heard of before just doing this amount of research for Stephen, how many more are out there? What would happen if I really went hunting? Is there a book's worth? Because, of course, one thing I'd found out in looking for poems for Stephen was that no one had ever collected this work together. All the books of women's spirituality which exist, no one had put together women speaking for themselves. And so it just began to seem to me like a book which was crying out to be done, and after a while I realized I might have to be the person to do it.
In the course of your research, you learned about a community of spiritual women. Could you tell about that? I was fascinated to read about it.
Yes, I was too. That was the greatest social discovery for me, the phenomenon known as the Beguines. These were women who lived in northern European countries between the 12th and 14th centuries. They would have become nuns, except the church stopped opening new convents. There was an imbalance in the population because of the Crusades and because of the Black Plague, and the church didn't want to house any more of what they considered the excess women of Europe.
No room at the inn.
Exactly. Women who had a genuine spiritual vocation and who weren't just looking for a way to live if they couldn't find husbands, they began by meeting together in one another's houses 5 times a day for shared prayer. And by the height of the movement in the early 14th century, you could find up to 14,000 women living together in walled cities under voluntary vows of poverty, chastity, and the doing of good works. They had no formal tie to the church. The church rather reluctantly would give them a priest to do mass and confession, but didn't help with the administration at all. And so here you had women creating an entire culture for themselves. Many wonderful mystics and writers took refuge in these communities, and that's how I stumbled across them, was because of the excellence of the writing which came out of them. They ended in the 14th century. The movement had become so large that the church began to find it threatening. And the way they put an end to it was by starting to accuse the women of a heresy with a very wonderfully appropriate name, the heresy of the free spirit. Which I see as, and the women actually, they tried very hard not to do what the church was accusing them of, but it's interesting in that it's a foreshadowing of Protestantism, in that the heresy of the free spirit was the false idea, according to the church, that you could have your own relationship to God independent of the sacraments.
And these were the Beguines.
Yes.
And where was the community?
Throughout northern France, the Netherlands, the Low Countries, Germany, that whole swath.
It's so interesting that, of course, this would be called a heresy, because I think of the early American poet Anne Bradstreet and the accusations against her work, that she was sectarian, that she was a witch. There was so, it seems, any ecstatic statement is accused of heresy.
And this is true, of course, you know, perhaps especially true for women in cultures where women were not supposed to speak at all, let alone speak ecstatically. But it's also true for male mystics. Always when someone steps into their own definition of spiritual experience, they are literally, at least in the past, putting their lives at risk. Many of the women in this book who we know as saints could equally easily have been burned at the stake. It could have gone either way for them. Teresa of Avila, for example, was examined closely by the Inquisition. Hildegard of Bingen, who had visions, if they hadn't been approved by the Pope and by a famous male mystic of the time, she too would have been burned. And some of the women in the book were.
I'm curious whether you know this. I I've always wondered what it was about Saint Teresa that drew Gertrude Stein to write Four Saints in Three Acts. Do you happen to know?
I don't know. I know Teresa is a tremendously attractive figure to many people, but I don't know what Gertrude Stein was drawn to.
Because, I fell in love with that opera, Four Saints in Three Acts, and one of the interesting things in the course of reading Women in Praise of the Sacred was to find how much doggerel goes into worship. People made fun of Gertrude Stein for Pigeons on the Grass, Alas, or When This You See, Remember Me, but repetitive rhythms and easy rhymes go very much into the state of trance and adoration.
Right. Well, a Native American friend of mine explained to me when we were talking about repetition in sacred language, he said that repetition is what holds the world together against the forces of chaos. Repetition represents the orderly universe. And of course, ecstatic poetry is going to have both forces in it. It will both show how the universe is held together and also show how it is broken open.
I'm speaking to Jane Hirschfield, the editor of Women in Praise of the Sacred, an anthology of 43 centuries of spiritual poetry by women. Can you account for, in a culture that really, in a sense, has shunned poetry, the popularity of these books of sacred poetry, yours and Stephen Mitchell's? Mm-hmm. They seem to be vastly desired. I mean, from the very first time I started carrying The Enlightened Heart, people started buying copies of it. And your book, too. People virtually stop me and ask me, well, what is that? You know, that seems,
oh, how wonderful.
Yeah, oh, it's great.
Well, I think it's the intersection. I've always felt that poetry isn't quite as shunned in this culture as we often think it is. While there are relatively few people who read poetry on a regular basis, I also think that almost everyone, at moments of great transition in their life, at weddings, at funerals, at the moment you fall in love, at the moment a love relationship ends, people turn to poetry. And so people also have a great hunger for the spiritual in our culture. And so these books are places where those two things intersect. Poetry is a very good form of language for holding spiritual experience because it's very permeable. It's open to possibilities that normal speech has a hard time holding. Poetry is designed to hold experiences which are difficult to be held in language. And so I think these books fulfill a real need and hunger in America, and something, I mean, people also think this isn't a very spiritual country, but the very fact of what we aren't shows what we desire because it's missing. And so some small percentage actually does find a book like this and says, yes, I want that by my bedside table. That helps me conduct my life. It helps me understand my life.
I wanted to make a transition to your own poetry collected in the new book, The October Palace, also published by HarperCollins. And for that, I thought I'd begin by asking you to read a poem. I very much like the final poem in the collection, The Stone of Heaven, and because it is about the connection between the naming of the mundane things of earth and the spiritual qualities of the everlasting world, the world that we don't have names for, I thought it would be a good way to make that transition.
Here, where the rivers dredge up the very stone of heaven, we name its colors. Mutton fat jade, kingfisher jade, jade of apple skin green. And here, in the glittering hues of the Flemish masters, we sample their wine. Rest in their windows, sun warmth, cross with pleasure their scrub tile floors. Everywhere the details leap like fish, bright shards of water, out of water, facet cut, swift moving on the myriad bones. Any wood thrush shows it. He sings not to fill the world, but because he is filled. But the world does not fill with us. It spills and spills, whirs with owl wings, rises, sets, stuns us with planet rings, stars, a carnival tent, a fluttering of banners. O baker of yeast-scented loaves, sword dancer, seamstress, weaver of shattering glass, O whirler of winds, boat swallower, germinant seed, O seasons that sing in our ears in the shape of O, we name your colors mutton fat, kingfisher, jade. We name your colors anthracite, orca, growth tip of pine. We name them arpeggio, pond. We name them flickering helix within the cell, burning coal tunnel, blossom of salt. We name them roof-flashing copper, frost-scented morning, smoke singe of pearl. From black flowering to light flowering, we name them. From barest conception, the almost not thought of, to heaviest matter, we name them. From glacier-lit blue to the gold of iguana, we name them. And naming, begin to see, and seeing, begin to assemble the plain stones of earth.
Now, in this poem, it seems that I hear a bit of Christopher Smart. Am I imagining this?
You're not imagining that. You wouldn't be imagining it if you heard a bit of Hopkins also.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I think one always works in a tradition, you know, and there is a tradition of how to speak of the richness of the world, and I'm sure my language draws from that language. I think it's also one of the ways we meet the sacred is by praising it and naming it. And litany, I mean, Christopher Smart goes straight back to biblical litany, and that also is something which I think rests on a fundamental gesture of human beings when they approach the unapproachable, which is to start naming, to start listing, to say, look at the variety of this. And that goes earlier than even biblical literature. You can find it.
A lot of these poems deal with the question about containing and containment. Does the world fill you? Do you fill the world? Does the world spill out from you? And I wanted to ask about the relationship of poetry to Buddhism. Are you a poet because a Buddhist? Is Buddhism the subject of the poetry? Does the poetry contain the Buddhism or vice versa? Do you have a way of talking about that?
Well, I can talk about it historically a bit, and we'll see where it goes from there. I was writing poetry before I became interested in Zen, and I will say Zen because that's what I know. Buddhism is very vast and has many faces. So poetry obviously came first. Poetry actually led me to Zen practice because it was not through reading Alan Watts or Gary Snyder or anything like that, but through reading ancient Japanese and Chinese poems which had a Buddhist underpinning to them. Mm-hmm. They weren't even about Buddhism. They simply showed the mind of Buddhism in what they said and how they said it, that I first became interested in Zen. I then ended up taking a rather long detour in my path as a poet because where other people in my position were going to graduate school, I thought, you know, I've been in school a long time and my poems are either about falling in and out of love or things that I've read in books since I didn't have much life experience. And I thought I needed to find out what it meant to be a human being if I was ever going to be a good poet. And I went to a Zen monastery instead of graduate school and stopped writing during all the time I was there and knew that writing would either be there for me or not at the other end of that process.
Well, in addition to being about falling in and out of love, a lot of the poems in the October Palace seem to be about falling, about things acquiring their weight and falling to the earth as though magnetized there, as if the things of the earth must live there.
Yes.
That the world of the spirit is too light and all of our heaviness takes us back to the earth.
Yes. And that, I mean, that's very perceptive and very true of the book. And I think that's probably my attempt in my own poetry to correct my own life, that maybe my failure when I started out in life was to be too heady, too transcendental, and that what I needed both in Zen practice, which is very much the practice of attention to the things of this world and staying here, in my poetry too, I'm always calling myself back to the good things of Earth so I don't go flying off the handle and get all, too much in the mind.
How does one pay attention to the thing itself and to the language simultaneously, since they seem to have such different qualities?
Well, one pays attention to the thing itself in one's life, in going about the life. You know, again, Zen practice is conducted not just on the meditation cushion, but in washing the dishes and in pulling the weeds and in taking the dog out. And my hope is that if I suffuse my life deeply enough with this awareness, when I then begin to write, which of course when you're writing, you're not with anything except your mind and whatever tool you're using to conduct your mind onto the page, whoever you are is going to come out when that part of the mind that poetry comes from begins to speak. And so my job as a poet is to develop a life which when the poet begins to speak is going to be saying something worth hearing, mostly me myself worth hearing first, you know, long before any audience.
I have a very dumb question. This is in a way so basic that I think it has to be asked. I'm speaking, by the way, to Jane Hirschfield about her collection of her own poetry, The October Palace. You know, when kids are in school, they're sat down and asked to count the syllables in a line, and then if they get something of an ear, the number of stresses per line. And I wonder, how much of that do you think is essential to the reading of poetry for a layman, you know, for someone who simply enjoys it?
Absolutely not essential. One thing that I did when I first began working in the world as a poet was teach workshops through the California Poets in the Schools program, and we never began with meter or technical questions. We began with the heart of poetry and how poetry can hold parts of your life and say parts of your life. I think it's very useful for poets to be schooled in metrics, in sound qualities, to know the names of what we do. Part of developing your craft is making things conscious. But readers do not need to be conscious of these things. If we're doing our job right as poets, the power of what we're saying and how we're saying it will go straight from our hearts to the readers, or even preferably the listeners, because of course poetry is meant to be heard, even if it's you hearing it in your head as you encounter it on the page. But I don't think readers need to be schooled.
Because it's funny, I think about Keats sometimes, and he said about writing a poem that unless it comes as leaves to the tree, it had better not come at all. And for many, many years as a reader, poetry didn't come naturally to me. Until one day, at a time when I thought it would never in fact happen, because I'll confess it, I thought that people who told me that they loved poetry we're making it up.
We're that's wonderful.
It just hadn't happened
to me. It was a conspiracy.
Yeah, no. And then one tiny poem, it was one of those sort of riddle thing poems by Charlie Simich, just
penetrated.
And, you know, what like they used to say about pistachio nuts, that you could use the shell of one to open the next. Poems started happening.
Aww.
Not as a writer, but as a reader. And so I always like to address that potential fear of poetry that might be in listeners and to say that it can disappear suddenly.
Mm-hmm. That's a wonderful story. It's a story about initiation, that one has to be initiated into this world. And of course, you know, in a better world, parents would be initiating their children. It would simply be a part of our lives, as it was for our grandparents' generation. It's fairly recently that poetry has fallen away from the general culture as a way to enter your own life. So I hope that accidents like yours keep happening.
How do you know who you are in devotion? I want to clarify that mysterious question. But, you know, of the many backgrounds that we come to as Americans, Judeo-Christian, political, adapting as the transcendentalists did, one's own religion. How, in addition to finding your voice, I would imagine in spiritual poetry, you must discover your theology. How is that done?
This is not the question I thought you were asking when you started.
Well, answer both.
The first question was, how do you discover yourself in devotion? And in fact, I think what you do is lose yourself in devotion, that you turn your attention to something which is not yourself, which, of course, sometimes you do that by looking inward. You look inward in order to look outward. But the second question of how you discover a theology, that's a wonderfully mysterious one. I mean, for me, how can I explain how, having been raised in a secular Jewish household, why did Zen resonate so strongly mm-hmm. for me? I can't say. I can only say that as soon as I was exposed to those ideas, I went, yes, this seems right. This is how the world looks to me. There is a saying in Buddhism that all practices are just medicines for what ails you, and that in fact, when you have entered the mind of realization, all the particular descriptions, the particular paths fall away. And that I certainly don't think there's any one right or wrong way to have a spiritual life. You know, none is better than the other. They're all paths on the same mountain, just facing different directions. But there's only one mountain. And so I think one simply recognizes when one of these descriptions of spiritual life touches your heart deeply, and that's the one you follow. And often, of course, it's the one of your birth family, but sometimes it's something from far away, as it was for me.
And how does spiritual practice, an unanswerable question, but just a stab, enter poetic practice?
I think they're very parallel paths, especially, you know, my own spiritual practice, which is one of paying attention. I think both require you to enter a state of mind which is both very aware and also very open. The difference between them is in Zen meditation, what you are open to doesn't have language attached to it. And in poetry, what you are open to is, in fact, the language which arises out of silence when you still yourself enough to listen. And so they seem to me, I'm sure that my experience on the meditation cushion and my experience as a writer are helping and supporting each other because they feel so similar, and yet there's something very different as well.
I've been speaking to Jane Hirschfield, the editor of the anthology Women in Praise of the Sacred, 43 Centuries of Spiritual Poetry by Women, and the author as well of her own book of poems, The October Palace by Jane Hirschfield, both of them published by HarperCollins. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Michael.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold in books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse. Pop, die.